From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the National Endowment for the Arts. Is it a pork barrel for the cultural elite? Or is it making a valuable contribution to America's cultural and economic life? House Speaker Newt Gingrich would like to abolish the NEA. We'll hear from two people who agree, art critic Hilton Kramer and Lynn Munson of the think tank the American Enterprise Institute. John Brademas, who helped write the legislation that created the NEA, will tell us why he still supports it. And New York Times chief cultural correspondent Paul Goldberger will also speak in favor of federal funding for the arts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Survivors of the Japanese earthquake town of Kobe have been fleeing the danger of fires, collapsing wreckage, and broken water and gas pipes. Hundreds of thousands of people have been pouring out of the town in cars and on bicycles, also many on foot. Phone lines are down and families are trying to find each other. The death toll in the quake has gone over 3,000, making it the deadliest earthquake to strike Japan since 1923. Nearly 900 people are still listed as missing, and more than 14,000 people are injured. Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev have wrapped up 2 days of talks, focusing largely on the fighting in Chechnya. Cindy Scheiner reports from Geneva.
Intense fighting in Chechnya overshadowed the talks between Christopher and Kozyrev. The ideas and views that were exchanged will unlikely have any effect on the conflict in the short term. Christopher stopped short of warning Kozyrev that Washington would cut aid to Russia unless the bloodshed in Chechnya ended. But he said the U.S. administration couldn't control what Congress decided to do with aid money.
What we don't want to see is a Russia mired in a military quagmire that erodes reform and tends to isolate Russia internationally.
Kozyrev told Christopher that Russia's commitment to reform was unwavering and that elections were the best way to allow the Chechens to determine their future. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Scheiner in Geneva.
A daughter of the late Malcolm X pleaded not guilty today in federal court in St. Paul, Minnesota, to charges that she conspired to murder Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. The trial of Kabila Shabazz has been set for March 27th. Tom Fudge of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Kabila Shabazz looked timid, her eyes cast down as she entered a packed courtroom to respond to charges she conspired to kill Louis Farrakhan, the man the Shabazz family believes was responsible for the murder of Malcolm X. Outside the courthouse, the defendant's mother, Betty Shabazz, expressed her support for her daughter.
I'm the one that carried her for 9 months in my belly, and that attachment will never be cut. I don't care who attempts to.
Defense attorneys claim Shabazz has been set up in an attempt by federal authorities to divide America's black leadership. Last night, Farrakhan said he also believes the charges against Shabazz are bogus. Betty Shabazz said she was impressed by what she called Farrakhan's humanity in making that statement. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Fudge in St. Paul, Minnesota.
General Motors workers went on strike today at a plant in Flint, Michigan that makes parts for GM cars, but the parts also were sold to other U.S. automakers, so the shutdown could affect all of them. The strike is at an AC Delco complex, which makes components like spark plugs and air filters. Assembly plants could have to close quickly with the flow of parts interrupted. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 9 points in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is down a fraction of a point. This is NPR News. The government says business inventories rose 0.7 percentage point in November, while sales climbed a full point. But government analysts say retail sales, about one-third of all sales, began to slow in December. The city council in Fresno, California, has narrowly defeated a proposal to allow most adult residents to carry concealed weapons. Jason Bobian of member station KQED has this report.
After 4 hours of heated testimony and debate, the Fresno City Council rejected the proposed ordinance by a single vote. The measure would have given Fresno the most liberal gun permit policy in California, barring only convicted felons and the mentally ill from carrying loaded, concealed weapons in public. Instead, the City Council approved a proposal which essentially leaves current policy unchanged. Discretion to distribute permits will remain with the police chief. The Fresno police haven't issued a concealed weapons permit since 1987. Despite its 4-3 defeat, proponents of the measure say the intense debate generated by the issue shows the need for a less restrictive policy. The police chief says he's willing to consider issuing more permits, but will continue to require applicants to demonstrate a need for the concealed weapons. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Beaubien, reporting.
The judge in O.J. Simpson's murder trial cut back today on Simpson's privileges to receive visitors, which had been more generous than those given to other inmates. Judge Lance Ito ordered the defense team to explain each of many material witnesses permitted to visit Simpson in a reserved room in the jailhouse. Sheriff's Department officials have complained that a lot of the people considered witnesses appear to be regular visitors. Other inmates are restricted to only 2 regular visits, totaling 1 hour a week. Court papers filed by the sheriff's department say one visitor listed as a material witness was a writer who saw Simpson 15 times in the reserved room and apparently used their discussions in co-authoring Simpson's book. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Federal funding for the arts is again the subject of debate in America. The Republican leaders of the House of Representatives would like to abolish the National Endowment for the Arts. The arts community is mobilizing to save it. The fight over the NEA's future is raising provocative questions about the roles of art and government in American culture. In the next hour, we'll hear from both sides of the debate. The NEA was created by Congress in 1965 and provides grants to arts institutions as well as individual artists. Its budget this year is $167.4 million. In the spirit of disclosure, we want to let you know that Fresh Air receives funding from the NEA, which represents about 2.7% of the total Fresh Air budget. My first guest, Hilton Kramer, is former chief art critic of the New York Times. He left the Times in 1982 to edit the art journal The New Criterion, which he co-founded. He describes it as politically conservative, aesthetically modernist. Kramer says it's time to abolish the NEA.
My general view of funding, federal funding of the arts, has changed a good deal in the nearly 30 years since the NEA was founded in 1965. At the beginning, I was a very enthusiastic supporter of what the NEA was doing, because I felt, certainly as far as grants to individual artists were concerned, they were going to the right people, that is, both in terms of talent and need. But as the agency has grown into a huge bureaucracy, and as its budget has expanded, I think it has shown itself to really be incapable of discharging its functions in a way that is not detrimental to the life of art in this country.
Are your main objections to the way the agency functions now, or do you object to federal funding of the arts?
Well, I'm not sure that you can today, in 1995, separate those questions, because we now have enough experience with the NEA, I mean, nearly 3 decades, to show us that a large government bureaucracy is really incapable of making the distinctions that are necessary to make wise judgments in the arts. Judgments in the arts cannot be made through a bureaucratic process.
The people who are making the decisions on the NEA panels are usually fellow artists, arts teachers, arts critics. They're not government bureaucrats.
Well, in theory, they are all, independent artists, museum curators, directors, and so on. In practice, the peer panel system has become totally corrupted through having become a nucleus of what are called grant farmers. And this corruption of the peer panel process was the focus of the Brademus Garment Commission's report a number of years ago, in which they looked into the peer panel process and declared it corrupt and just riddled with conflicts of interest. We all know, those of us who have followed the history of the NEA, we all know dozens and dozens of stories, true stories about panels in which, you know, artist A or museum curator A leaves the room while the rest of the panel discusses his application for money. And then they vote his, you know, the artist B, C, and D vote the grant for artist A. Then artist A comes back into the room. Artist B leaves the room, and they deliberate on his application to the agency. It's a corrupt system. I once did an informal survey of artists I knew, both in New York and in Maine, where I go in the summer, where there are a great many artists from all over the country. I couldn't find one who had ever served on these peer panels. And these are artists of many different persuasions, different generations, different styles, different sexes, and ethnic backgrounds. The peer panel system is itself a bureaucratic creation.
What about what you've described as the long-term needs of culture in a political democracy? Do you think that the long-term needs require a degree of federal funding?
I do not. I think that the it's a great mistake to believe that the government really does play a significant role in the life of art in this country. The life of art in this country is determined by a great many private citizens, artists, art collectors, producers, private patrons, and art institutions that have their own standards and their own histories. And most artists I know, and I know a great many artists, most artists I know never even think about the NEA. I mean, the NEA isn't even a dot on their horizon. They remain completely untouched by its activities. The real life of art in this country goes on in a totally separate sphere from anything the government gets involved in.
Do you think that the arts should survive in the commercial marketplace without outside assistance?
No, I don't think that what I would call the fine arts are capable of surviving in the commercial marketplace on their own, and never have been. I think in a country and economy as wealthy as ours, and a culture in which the arts are so highly valued, that there's plenty of wealth to support the arts without the government agency. After all, as everyone knows, the actual amount of money that the NEA puts into the life of art in this country is minuscule compared to the entire economy of the arts in America.
Advocates of the NEA are always quick to point out that the United States actually spends far less money in support of the arts than many European countries do, and many other countries around the world.
Well, that's true, but the reason for that is that in most European countries, the principal arts institutions are themselves state-owned, but it's had, in many cases, a tremendously detrimental effect on the arts. I mean, in France, I'm told the government buys more than 50% of the contemporary paintings and sculptures that are produced in France. And when was the last time you heard of a French painter you were interested in? I mean, there hasn't been a significant French painter to come out of Paris, in a quarter of a century.
I'd like you to analyze the current political debate over NEA funding and tell me what you think the biggest issue is in the political arena, what the political debate is really about.
Well, I think the political debate about the government funding of the arts is about several things. One is that there's a general and growing feeling of distaste about having a centralized agency in Washington determining what is to be performed, what is to be created, what is to be supported in communities all over the country. Another issue is more marginal, but it has greater power to influence opinion, and that is the, you know, what I would call the obscenity issue or the issue of avant-garde extremism the Mapplethorpe, Serrano, and other such cases. But I think that the one of the crucial issues at stake in the debate about the NEA is that the feeling that the government doesn't have a legitimate role to play. The government is not, a government agency is not in a position to make sound judgments about the way the arts should be performed and supported in all over the country, in a country as big and diverse as ours is.
You're currently writing a book, I believe, A Cultural History of Abstract Art?
Right.
I'm wondering if what you're steeped in now in writing that book applies to your thinking on the NEA, if there's any lessons you think can be learned now from studying A Cultural History of Abstract Art.
Well, certainly one lesson to be learned from the history of abstract art in America is that its greatest achievements had absolutely nothing to do with government support of the arts. I mean, figures like Mark Rothko or Willem de Kooning, and in a later next generation, Helen Frankenthal or Richard Diebenkorn. Those artists didn't enjoy government grants. I mean, the whole New York School of Abstract Expressionism was something that took place at a great distance. A few of the older members of the New York School were on the WPA project in their younger days, but they were not there because of the way they were painting. That was a relief program during the Depression, and what has been called the triumph of American painting in the New York School is a perfect demonstration of the fact that the government had no role to play in it. The same thing is true of the great period of American poetry in the 20th century. I mean, Robert Frost, Wallace Stevens, I mean, T.S. Eliot, Marianne Moore. I mean, none of those artists had anything to do with government grants. I mean, they made their own way.
One argument that's made against the NEA is that a lot of the art that's funded is controversial, and taxpayers shouldn't have to fund art that they disapprove of.
Well, certainly the NEA has funded some very appalling stuff. That certainly is not doesn't represent the majority of the grants that are made by the NEA, only a very tiny minority of the grants, a very small number. But I think it is that small number of what we might call outrage grants is indicative of the agency's indifference to public opinion. I mean, the agency really feels it's their money that is being dispensed. They never really quite understand that it's the taxpayers' money that they're giving away, and that they, if it's a government grant, then they're accountable.
You've said basically that the NEA approach has little to do with the real life of art in American culture. Can you talk a little more about what the real life of art is?
The real life of art takes place in the lives of artists who work at their own speed, work according to the dictates of their own talents and vision. Many of them work at other jobs. They find ways to survive just as artists have always done in this country, just as they've did in Paris, as they did in Rome and Berlin and St. Petersburg. They struggled if they didn't have private means, and most of them didn't. And it's exactly the way the real life of art takes place today. You look at the exhibitions that are in the New York galleries. I dare say not more than 1% of those artists have ever received a penny of government money. What you see the NEA supporting now is a certain kind of socially determined art productions.
What does that mean?
Well, because the grants have gone on the basis of the either the gender, race, ethnic background, regional location of the recipients. There are no aesthetic standards that are being applied, as nearly as I can tell. The real life of art takes place among individuals who live their lives and do their work as individuals, and who are not either looking to a government agency to support them, or are expected, or in many cases don't even want it.
Hilton Kramer edits the arts journal The New Criterion. Coming up, John Brademas speaks in support of federal funding for the arts. He chairs the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities. This is Fresh Air. Hilton Kramer says the NEA's review process for awarding grants has become corrupt and riddled with conflicts of interest. He cites a 1990 report by a bipartisan commission which was asked to review grant-making procedures. The commission recommended several reforms. The commission was co-chaired by John Brademas and Leonard Garment. Brademas helped write the legislation that created the NEA. He's a former Democratic congressman from Indiana who now chairs the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. I asked Brademas if he agrees with Hilton Kramer's assessment of the NEA review process.
No, I do not. And I may say that Hilton was one of the few journalists who, at least in his review of our 1990 report, seemed to understand what it was that we were recommending. We were very strong in urging, that the sole authority of the chairman of the NEA to decide on grants be reinforced, and that the chairman be free to reject recommendations made by the panels. We also urge steps to reduce the conflicts, to reduce any conflicts of interest on the panels. For example, we said that the panelists shouldn't be allowed to sit on a panel that was looking at applications from organizations with which they were affiliated, and we said that the pool of panelists ought to be included, be expanded to include persons who knew something about the arts but didn't earn their living in them. Those reforms have been made, and I think it's simply not fair, not accurate, and it corrupts the English language to make the kind of charges that Hilton Kramer, with whose views I on many occasions agree, but not in this respect.
What do you say to the charge that a federal bureaucracy, like the NEA, is just not capable of making good aesthetic decisions?
Well, basically that's not an accurate way to make the point, because recommendations for making grants come up through the panel process, panels of persons who are knowledgeable about the arts, and therefore it's not a matter of a lot of bureaucrats sitting around deciding that we'll say yes to this one and no to that one. So I just don't think that's a fair or factually based argument.
Many of the NEA's critics charge that the NEA serves a cultural elite. What do you say to that?
Well, I would ask if it is elitist to provide funds for, say, a show at a great museum to which children are brought by their parents. I think of a recent show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, one of the most famous museums in the world, for the Matisse exhibition. Nearly 1 million people came to that show, and there was a special educational program for children and their parents. You have, through the NEA, seen some 14,000 artists in residence in schools all over the United States. Enormously important. We've seen folk arts programs at the NEA help support gospel singing, Native American dance, or programs for the elderly or physically disabled persons in rural parts of New England. So to say that the NEA is solely an elitist operation is, if you will allow me to say so, nothing but an elitist argument without foundation in fact.
What are your concerns about what will happen to art and culture in America if the NEA is abolished?
Well, I think it will be a giant step back. It will be as if the United States of America, the greatest, wealthiest democracy in the history of humankind, has made a public statement that that the arts, that the humanities, that the institutions of learning and of culture don't matter, that they are of little consequence, that we are solely a materialist society with no concern for the spiritual. What we would be saying is that we have little pride in the culture of our country, and I think that's not a positive way to enter the 21st century.
You're the chair of the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities, and it's part of your job to encourage private philanthropy of the arts. What are you hearing from private patrons and corporate donors about if they think they'll be able to jump in and make up the difference if the NEA ceases to exist?
What I hear is very clear and very blunt. They will not be able to make up the difference. They will not fill the gap. As I myself chair a corporate foundation, I deal with these matters with that hat on. And as the pressures on arts organizations all over the United States are intense and intensifying, the elimination of the National Endowment for the Arts would not mean that their needs would be met or that the funding gap would be filled by the private sector. The public-private partnership is essential to support of the arts in the United States.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, good to talk to you.
John Bradham is chair of the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities. More on federal funding of the arts in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the National Endowment for the Arts. Does it serve the cultural elite or enhance cultural life throughout America? We continue our debate on federal funding of the arts. Lynn Munson says abolish the NEA. She's the former special assistant to the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities and now research associate with the American Enterprise Institute. Paul Goldberger says the federal government should continue to support the arts. He's the chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. The debate about the NEA continues on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton is trying to head off a movement in Congress to block the $40 billion in loan guarantees the White House has pledged to Mexico. The money would guarantee loans that Mexico may use to prop up its currency. Administration officials have been warning of a sudden increase in illegal immigrants from Mexico if the economic crisis there is not eased. And Mr. Clinton told a group of business leaders in Washington today that the loan guarantees are not foreign aid.
They are not a gift. They are not a bailout. They are not United States government loans. They will not affect our current budget situation. Rather, they are the equivalent of co-signing a note that Mexico can use to borrow money on its own account. And because the guarantees are clearly not entirely risk-free to the United States, Mexico will make an advanced payment to us like an insurance premium. No guarantees will be issued until we are satisfied that Mexico can provide the assured means of repayment.
The president also said the Mexico crisis could spread to other countries in Latin America and Asia if the U.S. does not step in. Japanese authorities now report more than 3,000 people dead in the massive earthquake. Most of them are in the city of Kobe, where the quake unleashed devastation far beyond what the Japanese people had been led to expect by engineering experts, who said they were building earthquake-proof structures. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports that more than 100,000 people are sleeping in emergency shelters, and authorities have not been able to restore public services quickly.
The damage also extends to those very basic utilities. In the past 36 hours, Kobe was struck with a terrible power outages. Nearly a million people had no electricity. Many went without gas supplies. Water was suspended in some areas. And you are beginning to hear a growing chorus of people asking, what went wrong? How is it that this country that touts itself as and prides itself on being technologically advanced in dealing with earthquake preparedness could come to such a state?
NPR's Julie McCarthy in Tokyo. In addition to the 3,000 known dead, nearly 900 more people are missing, and more than 14,000 are injured. The judge in O.J. Simpson's murder trial ruled today that family members of victims Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman can sit in the courtroom for most of the trial. The defense had asked that those relatives who will be called as witnesses not be allowed to view the trial until after they testify. With workers on strike at a GM parts plant in Flint, Michigan, more contract talks are being held. The factory makes spare parts that are used at GM and other plants. This is NPR News in Washington. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1.5 points to close at 3928.98. Declines led advances by a narrow margin in heavy trading of 344 million shares. The president of the Mormon Church is suffering from the most serious form of prostate cancer. 87-year-old Howard W. Hunter was diagnosed after being treated for exhaustion. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The Mormon Church and the Mormon president's doctor say in a joint statement that Howard W. Hunter is being treated now for cancer of the prostate gland, which has spread to his bones. The doctor called his condition serious, though Hunter is resting at home. The cancer first appeared in 1980, but was not publicly revealed until today. Hunter has suffered several other serious ailments, though his 7 months as Mormon president have been active, including travel abroad and a busy schedule at home. The church statement said the 87-year-old Mormon leader continues to function in his office and religious calling. Neither the doctor nor the church will comment on Hunter's prognosis. This particular type of cancer can be painful with little chance of long-term survival. Mormons believe their president is a prophet of God who serves at God's will until death. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Rodney King's lawyers are going to be paid $1.6 million by the city of Los Angeles. They had asked a federal judge to order the city to pay them three times that amount. But the judge says the lawyers were out of line in asking to be paid for the time they spent representing King at media events or on talk shows. The city is paying the attorneys because King won his civil suit over his 1991 beating by police, and the law allows a successful plaintiff in a federal civil suit to have his legal fees paid by the defendants. The UN commander has gone to Tuzla to try to rescue UN peacekeepers being blockaded by Bosnian government troops. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Congress is debating the future of many federally funded programs. House Speaker Newt Gingrich has called for abolishing the National Endowment for the Arts, a federally funded program which provides grants to artists and arts groups. My first guest in this half hour, Lynn Munson, says it's time to dismantle the NEA. Munson is a research associate at the think tank the American Enterprise Institute. For 2 years, she worked at the National Endowment for the Humanities as special assistant to Director Lynn Cheney, who was appointed by President Bush. Munson told me why she's in favor of abolishing the NEA.
Well, I think for the reasons that are most obvious. I mean, when we're cutting subsidies for farmers, when we're cutting subsidies for welfare mothers, and we should be doing all of these things because of the horrible budget deficit we're in, there's really no possible way we can justify further subsidies for the cultural elite.
What does cultural elite mean? Who are we talking about?
Well, it is, of course, a hard group to define. I think that with respect to the arts and the humanities endowments, and I should actually keep my remarks, of course, to the arts endowment, that's the focus of your show, that what it means are the elites of the art world, the people who get their works put on display and wonderfully reviewed in places like the New York Times, the people who have their work up in Soho and elsewhere and do very well in terms of getting reviewed by the mainstream art critics and art culture.
Now, I know you worked at the National Endowment for the Humanities in the chairman's office for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Were you opposed to the NEH at the time that you worked there?
Well, I was trying to play my part, as I think as was Lynn Cheney, who was the chairman at the time, in trying to do the best job we could in running a government agency very responsibly, and I think Lynn Cheney made a most courageous effort to do so. But I think that, if anything, my time at the NEH is what has most, informed my opinion in these matters now.
What did you see there or what happened there that reinforced your point of view that the government shouldn't be supporting the arts or humanities?
There's no doubt that the NEH is sponsored to many great products, but I think that these are things that could have found life without the NEH. As a matter of fact, I think it does a great disservice to scholars in America, to people who work on public projects like films and things of that sort, museum exhibitions, to say that these things would not exist if it wasn't for government subsidy.
Is there anything else that you saw during your 2 years at the NEH that made you even more opposed to federal funding for arts and humanities?
Well, in fact, there was. I mean, I think there's a real incidence of intellectual fraud going on as a result of government funding. I don't know if perhaps this happens in foundations, too, where someone, a scholar perhaps, submits an application to do X, and a couple years later when you get the final report back on the project, you see that they've actually done Y with your monies. Of course, when you're talking about federal taxpayer money, this becomes a real problem to worry about. Something that's in the news right now is a perfect example of this. A few years ago, when Lynn Cheney was chairman of the NEH, she gave a grant to the History Center out at UCLA to produce history standards. Well, the history standards were recently delivered a couple years, like I said, maybe 3 years after she'd given the original grant, and funding, of course, had been provided since then. The history standards are not what they promised to be. They promised to be a very balanced, objective, fair portrayal of American and world history. They ended up being quite otherwise. They tell a grim and gloomy story of America's history, focusing only on the things that we've done wrong and not at all on any of the things we've done right. And they, in fact, downplay every American hero that we've ever had. Everyone from scientists to major political figures, they, for example, never tell us that George Washington was our first president. They never mention Thomas Edison, Einstein, or the Wright brothers. There's very little you can do about it.
Just getting back to the issue of does the NEA serve the cultural elite, do you think that by some standards you would be considered yourself part of a cultural elite? You're an educated person. You've served on the NEH. You're a person who has done, I assume, works of scholarship as well as had important input into government affairs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, actually. I think of myself as someone who's if anything, an up-and-coming member of the cultural elite. I think I've yet to fully earn my place as a member of the cultural elite, and it's not exactly something I'm striving for. But when I say cultural elite, what I'm referring to is definitely something from which I would exclude myself, in that it involves being... It's so hard to define, but... I think it involves being invested in an orthodoxy, which has become a way of thinking about our cultural in America that plays according to a very specific cultural and political agenda. And any deviation from that agenda automatically casts you out as a member of the cultural elite. What I'm talking about is this difference I was speaking to, I think, earlier about... how there are representational artists who I know who will not even apply to the Arts Endowment for funding because they know their work will not just not be treated fairly, but not taken seriously in the least. There's a very well-known representational artist by the name of Philip Perlstein who wrote an article some years ago, I believe in a publication of the College Art Association, talking about his experience in serving on a panel at the Arts Endowment. He showed up to find out that, and it was a visual arts panel, that all of the slides of work submitted by artists who worked in a figurative or in any way representational style had been culled out of the group that they were to review on the panel for funding. These were simply not considered serious enough, important enough, for consideration by the full panel. Mr. Perlstein talks in his article about having spent many hours on his own going through all the slides that had been taken out, putting them back into the group to be considered because he felt that they had been inappropriately removed from consideration.
You are, I believe, accusing the NEA of funding only what fits its orthodoxy of what good art is. And many people in the arts community say that the people who are attacking them have a different orthodoxy about what art is and what art shouldn't be and what art shouldn't address.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think both sides are hearing each other?
Well, I don't know whether or not both sides are hearing each other, but I know that our idea of abolishing the Arts Endowment certainly takes the problem off the table. I think abolishing the Arts Endowment would give us the opportunity to remove any hope for an orthodoxy to influence government funding for the arts, which I think is a very good thing.
Lynn Munson is a research associate at the American Enterprise Institute. Paul Goldberger speaks in favor of federal funding for the arts after a break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Goldberger is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times and the Times' former architecture critic and cultural news editor. He supports continued federal funding of the arts. But he says that the arts community, in trying to save the NEA, feels forced to represent the arts as sweet and lovable, not merely good, but good for you.
Right now, the arts lobby is in a terrible bind because they can either admit that art is difficult, that art exists in part to upend social values and thus risk even more wrath from the right, or they can try to fight the right with this one argument they have in their arsenal, which is to say art isn't just Mapplethorpe, it isn't just sort of weird, crazy, difficult stuff, it's all this nice, lovable stuff too, and it's the NEA helping some dance group in the middle of North Dakota, which would otherwise have no access to art or to culture in any way. And of course, all of that is true. I was just trying to take one step back and look at the broader picture and say, God, isn't it absurd that it has come to this, that in this country where we give a piddling amount to art anyway, we can get away with even that tiny amount only by pretending that it's trivial, sweet stuff.
Opponents of the NEA argue that if the arts are worth anything, they should be self-supporting as well. Do you buy that argument?
I don't think the arts have ever historically been self-supporting in any culture, in any society. I mean, Michelangelo was commissioned by the popes. The Medicis and other great patrons throughout history have paid the bill for art. Very rarely has the public been able to pay the bill through, you know, the conventional market economy.
But let me ask you a tough question. With benefits to people on welfare likely to be cut, how do you justify saving money for the arts?
By the same reasoning that led Winston Churchill to increase rather than decrease art subsidies in England at the height of World War II, when things were far more desperate than they are in this country right now, because he knew that quality of life and meaning of life were important at critical times, and that by investing in culture, by investing in the impact that culture can have on human life, on some sense of meaning, of spirituality even, in life, that those are investments that pay off in long-term and profound ways.
As an architecture critic, you've written a lot about the life of cities.
Mm-hmm.
One of the arguments being made to save the NEA is that arts institutions have great economic payoffs for city life. You know, the people go to the theater, they eat at a restaurant. People go to a concert, they come into town. You know, Lincoln Center is a real big tourist attraction in New York, so you're getting people from out of town into town. People into town, you're getting them to restaurants and to shops nearby. As someone who's really studied the life of cities, how much validity do you put in that argument?
Tremendous validity. In fact, the only real tangible benefit we can point to from the arts is, in fact, economic in this way. All the other benefits, the improving the quality of the sense of meaning in life that I referred to a moment ago, are intangible things that we can never measure in a hard way. But this one we can measure, and in fact, every study, every survey all over the country has proven that arts dollars are tremendously efficient recycling through the economy. They do amazing things. You invest a dollar in a concert or an opera subsidy, and that pulls crowds into Lincoln Center or into the Academy of Music in Philadelphia or what have you, and those crowds go to restaurants. Sometimes they come from out of town and stay in hotels. They do all kinds of things that keep all kinds of people in the urban economy busy.
Critics of the NEA say that the NEA is inherently elitist, that it supports a cultural elite. And I think the perception is that that cultural elite lives largely in big coastal cities. What do you think?
I think it's nonsense. I think it's true that there is more art and more culture in big coastal cities, or big cities in general, as has historically been true all over the world in every country, that art and culture gravitate toward large economic and population centers which can support it better, where there are more audiences available. You'd be very unlikely to be able to support, you know, an opera performance every night in, Butte, Montana. That more of it exists in the cities is as history has always been and no different here than anywhere else in the world. And the only difference between our country and the rest of the world there is that we seem to think there's something weird about it, because we've always been so oddly suspicious of our cities, unlike every other country in the world, which seems to look at its largest cities with pride rather than this kind of hatred that we feel in this country for it. So that's the first part, the answer to the second part of your question. The first part, the question of elitism, I think is much more difficult and much more troubling, because it comes down really to a fundamental suspicion about the role of art and culture in general. We tend in this country to have a profoundly anti-intellectual bias, and to believe that there's something slightly suspicious about the arts. I think there is still, even at this late moment in our history, this belief on the part of many Americans that, you know, if somebody earns a living writing or acting or playing music, you know, why don't they sort of get a real job? What is all this about? And this argument about elitism stems in large part from that feeling, which is rarely articulated as bluntly as I just have done, but somehow hovers over that argument or hides underneath it. The truth is, of course, NEA subsidies are not that elitist. And as Jane Alexander has argued tirelessly in the last few years, if the NEA has done anything, it's spread money around and make art less elitist. So there's another paradox to this whole situation, which is that as the NEA spends more and more money to subsidize arts groups all around the country and bring art and culture to more and more communities all around the country that might not have been exposed to it, it's getting attacked as being elitist.
My guest is Paul Goldberger, chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back with us in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the earthquake in Japan?
Well, we'll be hearing from our reporters in Japan about efforts there to clean up from the earthquake and to try to get food and relief supplies into Kobe, the city hardest hit. Also on today's program, we're going to continue our series, The Subject is Sex. This evening we hear from NPR reporter Jackie Lydon about the language of love and how the vocabulary of sex in America has changed. We'll bring people up to date. And also we'll be hearing from NPR correspondent Mike Schuster about why the U.S. and other countries want to help Mexico economically.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We've heard from several people today on both sides of the debate over federal funding for the arts. Our final guest, Paul Goldberger, is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. The last time around when the NEA was at the center of controversy, the argument against the NEA was pinned to controversial art, art that was considered sacrilegious and sexually perverse.
Yes.
Now the debate seems to have shifted to something more abstract, the federal role in funding of the arts. And I'm wondering what you think the debate is really about, if you think that there's a subtext underneath what's actually being addressed.
I think the debate of a couple of years ago has never fully ended. I think Jane Alexander has been very effective in going around the country trying to mute that old debate and shift things back toward the basic level of the goodness of federal art subsidies. And reminding everyone that it isn't all art that is viewed as sexually perverse or representing inappropriate values, that a tremendous amount of what the NEA supports is sort of, chicken soup. It's just fine. It's apple pie. She's been a very effective, articulate proponent of that view. However, I think the far right is not terribly convinced, but they know that they cannot completely contradict her. So they have moved with her to the sort of more central battleground of trying to simply get rid of the whole thing, saying that there's no real important role for federal subsidies, period. This is just not the federal government's business. You can say that all you want. I don't think I'll ever be convinced that the right isn't still trying to purge this country of either sexually explicit or provocative or politically radical art. In the end, this is about an amount of money that is so tiny, it's a fly speck in the federal budget, that there has to be some other political agenda at work, or why would anyone care? I mean, it's, you know, the Defense Department spends more in 5 minutes than the National Endowment does in a year. It has nothing to do with the federal deficit. It's too tiny an amount of money.
If federal funds to the arts are cut or eliminated, what effect do you think that would finally have on the arts?
You know, it would be devastating in certain cases, and to be perfectly frank, in others, I shouldn't say this because I don't want to give any ammunition to opponents of art subsidies, but in fact, you know, art will go on. It will not be the end of the world. It will stop. But an awful lot of very talented people who operate at the edge may fall off the edge, and that's what I fear most. I mean, Lincoln Center will go on. The Metropolitan Opera will not close down. They don't rise or fall on the NEA. What does are smaller institutions and outlying communities and individual artists of talent, many of whom have no other source of funds. And in the case of small institutions, very often the NEA is a validating tool, a legitimizing tool that has made other money possible. A grant from the NEA says to everyone that a small dance company in the middle of South Dakota is okay. We've checked it out. Our professionals have evaluated it, and these people are serious and they know what they're doing. And that validation, in turn, has often made other money possible.
What message do you think it would send if Congress cuts off funds for the NEA?
If Congress cuts off funds for the NEA, no matter how it's masked, no matter what anybody says about the proper role of the federal government, it will send the message today that the arguments put forth by the right a few years ago, when the debate over sexually explicit and subversive art was at its height, it will send the message that that debate still controls the agenda, and that the arguments made a few years ago ultimately still carry the day. And that's my greatest concern, that no matter how the whole thing is masked, no matter what new arguments are put forth, in the end, this will still be the right getting back at art it doesn't like.
Paul Goldberger is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. Our program on federal funding for the arts was produced by Naomi Person with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Joan Tuohy Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, advertising, TV, and American culture. We talk with Leslie Savin, advertising columnist for The Village Voice and author of the new book, The Sponsored Life. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.